Hello, Paul Barclay here. Welcome to 4A Radio on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and on the web. Today, the proposition that democracy is not for everyone is up for debate. And later, you'll hear from one of the world's leading solar energy researchers, Dr. David Mills, who'll argue that a non-carbon economy could have been established 100 years ago, but we took a wrong turn. In his recent Deakin lecture, David Mills will tell you how and why the photon economy could once again be the inspiration for our energy requirements. That's David Mills on the photon economy later on 4A Radio. But first, to the Sydney Opera House, the Festival of Dangerous Ideas and the IQ Squared debate that democracy is not for everyone. You'll hear opening arguments from the first two debaters. For the negative, John Keane, Professor of Politics at the University of Westminster in the UK, and to open the case for the affirmative, Carmen Lawrence, former Premier of Western Australia, former Federal Labor MP and Minister in the Keating government. She's currently Professorial Fellow at the University of Western Australia. So is democracy for everyone? Here's Carmen Lawrence.
This afternoon, I do want to argue that democracy is not for everyone, but I hasten to add, it should be. I want to speak to the evidence about democracy and how it functions, what's actually happening. Mine is a pragmatic assessment, not an idealised fantasy, not the stuff of soaring rhetoric, not Obama, but the hard-to-swallow stuff of reality, not the fairy stories that we tell ourselves, but the unforgiving evidence of falling short. In many ways, of course, it's a common human story. We're not perfect. But as long as we kid ourselves, we're unlikely to do anything about it, to improve our democracy. Democracy here and elsewhere is clearly not for everyone. Some have access to power and influence, others do not. Indeed, I think it's fair to say the majority do not. Some, in other words, are more equal than others. Animal Farm revisited. In part, this is a design fault. Voting once every few years for one or two parties is pretty minimal. But it's been exacerbated by the pervasive influence of moneyed interests underlined through paid lobbyists, campaign donations, through the relentless campaigning of media barons on particular issues like climate change, and of course, the collapse of our political parties. In reality, the great bulk of the population is excluded from the exercise of power. Ours, and indeed most democracies, are very indirect forms of democracy, one in which the work of governing is left to the few. The people, with the exception of a few privileged insiders, are kept at arm's length from the actual work of government. When was the last time you decided a policy? The very evolution of democracies, in fact, was accompanied by a powerful distrust of the people, especially the poor, the poorly educated, and women. Madison, one of the founding fathers of the US democracy, argued that citizens couldn't be trusted to identify the aggregate interests of the community, a task which should be left to their elected representatives who would do it all for us. As a result, most democracies are thin democracies. Citizens are relatively passive, and experts and elites do the actual work of government. As Rousseau acerbically observed, speaking of the UK, the English people believes itself to be free. It is gravely mistaken. It is free only during the election of members of Parliament. I don't even think that's true. As soon as the members are elected, the people is enslaved. It is nothing. This is government by an elected aristocracy, mediated by the political parties, or at least that once was the case before they became political corporations, almost entirely under the control of a few machine men and these days women. Historically, those with power have had to have it wrested from their hands, inch by inch. The property franchise was abolished, women got the vote, but stood at the margins of power for another 100 years. And if you turn your backs for a minute, those who control the reins of power take it back. And in my view, they have taken it back. We're happy, it seems, to recommend the export of democracy as the ne plus ultra of governance. Bush even thought he could spread it through the barrel of a gun to Iraq and Afghanistan, for example. And we seldom ask what it is we're actually advocating. What exactly is this democracy? What are its key values and characteristics? How do we judge the success of democracies, and how do we measure up? The minimum requirements, of course, of any democracy worthy of the name are that government should be elected, not stolen, as they were in Iran, Afghanistan, and in recent history in the US. All adults should have an equal right to vote, and all votes should be of equal value. And most would include, of course, protection of civil liberties, the protection of human rights. The democratic audit of Australia includes the quality of public debate, such as we're having here today, assessing the degree to which debate and discussion can be distorted by manipulation, strategising, deception, and restrictions on allowable communication. Not to mention what many regard as the core of democracy, the extent to which all citizens actively participate in the political life of the country. This, of course, requires respect for diverse views, open deliberation about decisions. If you think about that for a few minutes, you can see my problem. Our democracy doesn't measure up. It's characterised, in my view, by unsightly and factionalised squabbling, by self-interested, short-sighted people and groups. A lot of policies are the result of special pleading from those best placed to adroitly pressure and manipulate the system. Just watch the coal industry positioning on emissions trading all around the world. Yes, we do have more or less equal rights to vote and votes of equal value, but it can't be said that all citizens are equally able to influence their representatives. Business, I think, has acquired veto power in economic policy, and this establishes a vicious cycle. Belief that the ordinary views are ignored while preference is given to big business and to political cronies. Notice what a lot of politicians do when they leave politics. I don't need to remind a Sydney audience of the influence of campaign donations. Seen a bit of that around lately. Big donations do buy privileged access to MPs and ministers, in proportion, I think, to the amount of money donated. A chook raffle certainly won't do it. Ours is a donocracy, in which the number of shares you've purchased in the party of your choice determines your effective voting power. Lobbying by the well-heeled vested interests also skews the policy agenda in favour of what someone called the financially articulate. The champagnes and canapes, the slick gleaming presentations, the smooth and not so smooth lobbying, sometimes just arm twisting and corruption come closer to the mark, of the major corporations overwhelm the earnest pleading of small community groups and the disadvantaged. And there's no proper public record of this influence either. There is no level playing field, no equality of influence. And I don't think now any of the major players actually bother to seriously suggest that it is. Political parties, of course, once provided the avenue for people to influence their representatives in a principled way. They provided space for discussion, they settled policies before elections, they're a source of candidates, and, of course, a link between the wider community and MPs. Now political parties are largely vehicles for the career paths of a few paid officials. The voice is largely ignored in any case. It's largely ceremonial. And the factional games show the interests of a few insiders. And as a result, numbers in the political parties generally have plummeted. Parliament itself, of course, is largely in control of the executive. It's dominated by a disciplined bipolar system in the case of Australia. In my view, it's a theatre of meaningless ritual and confected biff. Media coverage is driven by the trivia of the day-to-day contest. And what we're seeing increasingly is a current system which is a rubber stamp model of government. The electors elect a party or leaders to govern. The government governs with total power to change the law and virtually do what it likes between elections. It doesn't help that the person who exercises the balance of power at the moment thinks that the earth is flat. We need to take back power. In my view, it's time we looked at these problems. Democracy should be for everyone, but it isn't. Thank you.
Carmen Lawrence, presenting the opening argument for the affirmative, the proposition before the House that democracy is not for everyone. To open the case for the negative, here's Professor John Keane. He's an Australian author and academic. Among his many books is the recent The Life and Death of Democracy. John Keane is currently Professor of Politics at the University of Westminster in the UK, but is soon to return to Australia to head politics at the University of Sydney. John Keane.
Ladies and gentlemen, there's danger in the air, so I'm going to argue against our distinguished, deluded opponents using shock tactics. Just around the corner from where I live in London, there is a pub called the Lord Palmerston. You may recall that he was a reactionary Home Secretary in the 19th century, famous for his bitchy remarks about democracy. And in a well-known, difficult conversation with a man named John Russell, who was the architect of the 1832 Reform Act, which was a tipping point in the struggle for democracy both in Britain and in its Australian colonies, pompous Lord Palmerston told Russell that history shows, and I quote, that power in the hands of the masses throws the scum of the community to the surface. Well, dear scum, good day. Offspring community of the 19th century struggle for democracy, here we are down under, gathered to discuss the merits of the most dangerous, whatever Germaine Greer or Reverend Hitchens has had to say, the most dangerous human idea ever invented, democracy. Palmerston's insult should remind us, sit back, don't relax, here comes the first shock, that until very recently, a wet, dreary Sunday afternoon gathering dominated by well-heeled middle-class people would typically have bad-mouthed democracy, condemned it as a formula for bad government and social disorder. So thank you to the organisers for keeping the tradition going. Thanks for the vital reminder that until roughly 1945, democracy, meaning the self-government of people, was a dirty word, a rotten ideal whose dogged defenders were thought deserving of transportation to the colonies, a spell behind bars, or a good flogging and hanging. Nowadays, of course, it's avowed Democrats, as Carmen Lawrence has pointed out, who sometimes do the violence, as in Iraq, often in the name of democracy, which rather raises the question that draws us together. Is democracy a universal idea, good for everybody in all times and places? Or is it, as Nietzsche said in the 19th century, a big bogus Christian metaphor? Or, in the 1930s, as the Baltimore satirist H.L. Mencken said sarcastically, government by orgasm. What a splendid idea, government by orgasm. He meant by that democracy, a grand ideal used by some to seduce the pants of others, to get them into bed with promises of satisfaction, convince them that it's good for all people and all places, only to disappoint them with its poor performance, its miserable impotence, its failure to satisfy, and worst of all, its bare-bottomed hypocrisy. Second shock. All previous arguments in favour of democracy to win over its sceptics and outright opponents are today exhausted. My grandmother in South Australia would have said they've had the biscuit. What she meant, or what I mean, is that we've inherited in the 21st century utterly dubious justifications of democracy that have become actually implausible or downright embarrassing. Let me list a few very quickly before I'm guillotined. The Athenian Democrats thought that demokratia was good, by far the best system of government, because it made the Athenian people and its polity a conquering empire. Once upon a time, in the age of representative democracy, its second historical phase, professed Democrats liked to say either that they had God on their side — that was the way many Protestants spoke in the 19th century anti-slavery movement, for instance — or that democracy was a good thing because it had history on its side. Sun Yat-sen in China in the 1920s talked like this before the real disasters of the 20th century disproved it. Or there was the dogma that democracy was the best form of government because it protected a set of earthly first principles, private property, above all, political order, and the greatest happiness of the greatest number. That was Jeremy Bentham's utility principle. All these old arguments are, I think, nonsense on stilts from yesteryear, which brings me to a third shock. Democracy, understood in our time as monetary democracy, as I call it, monetary, not monetary, as more than periodic fair, free, clean elections, but a permanent humbling of power. The attempt to keep power wherever it's exercised on its toes requires new imagination and desperately fresh thinking. But the sad reality is that democracy today has become a mantra. Everybody should be in favour of it because everybody in their right and reasonable mind is in favour of democracy. That's the way Amartya Sen likes to argue. Or its fortunes are hitched to what the philosophers call consequentialist arguments. In plain English, democracy is good for everyone because it produces desirable effects, like economic growth. Singapore and China disprove that, and there are ecological doubts against that argument. Or its claim that democracy promotes peace. Ah, yes, as in Iraq and Afghanistan, as before in Vietnam and Cambodia, Korea and firebombed radiated Japan. Or it's said that democracy is a universal ideal because it guarantees human rights that are said to be universal, which is, as my students would say, a tautology. It simply starts out with a premise that it concludes with. So three shocks in a row. Democracy, a precious old ideal that was until very recently universally condemned as dangerous, an ideal that has miraculously won over many millions of hearts and minds in all four corners of the earth, but an ideal that today, in my view, appears intellectually weak, dependent upon bogus reasoning and plain dogma. These weaknesses are grist to the mill of today's skeptics or outright anti-democrats, of whom there are rising numbers, not just on this podium, to my right, but in Moscow and Tehran, Beijing and Caracas. But take a deep breath, because here comes shock number four. Gradually, everywhere, because of the rotten and terrible things that have happened in our lifetime, aerial bombardment, mustard gas, genocide, concentration camps, total war, a brand new argument for democracy has surfaced. A new justification that I wish to submit shows that democracy is for everyone, as relevant in the workplace, the home and your local community, as it is in general elections, on battlefields, in cross-border organisations like the UN, the Copenhagen process, the WTO, and as relevant in Rangoon and Washington as it is in Sydney and Tehran. I call this new argument for democracy, forgive the highfalutin word, the hubris argument. Hubris, bullshit, arrogance, and the blindness and stupidity that follow. Democracy, I submit, is good for everyone because it both recognizes that some humans are arrogant, blind, foolish, power-hungry, enough to commit devilish acts, yet good enough to correct their own arrogance, blindness, folly, and hubris. The problem of hubris is, for me, the greatest ultimate challenge that this side of the debate has to face, that any system of concentrated and uncontested power has to answer for. Four decades ago, the American psychologist, you may not know him, Irving Janis, labeled hubris a type of behavior fed by groupthink. I like that. He showed how groupthink played a fundamental role in shaping the fiasco of the American invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs. But we have more recent examples of what happens when concentrated power reigns unchecked, actually brings about disastrous effects. Think for a second or two of the 17th floor of Manhattan's lipstick building, so-called, the no-entry floor where Bernard L. Madoff Investment Securities operated a $65 billion rip-off Ponzi scheme. Ponder the harassment, currently arrest and disappearance of supporters of Charter 08 in China. Think of the verbal torture of the show trials unfolding in Tehran, in which, incidentally, I've been named as a CIA MI6 agent. Closer to home, think of the massive damage done to people and biosphere of the Great Western Desert by British atomic testing in the 50s. Think of the stolen generation of young indigenous people. Think of the Howard's government decision to invade Iraq with little or no cabinet discussion. What's common to all of these is hubris. Hubris is no laughing matter. It damages people's lives, and its global footprint is widening. Hubris, I think, drives home the painful truth of the old proverb that fools never differ, that unchallenged power is dangerous, ultimately because it is blind to the great complexity of our universe, the kind of world that Reverend Hitchens described last night, a world of contingency, of great unknowns and great unintended consequences. Ladies and gentlemen, I rest my case and suggest to you that the key argument for democracy is it's the best weapon we have against hubris. Thank you.
Professor John Keane, the debate that democracy is not for everyone. Joining John Keane on the negative team was Amina Rassel-Bernardo, former presidential adviser on youth affairs. She's an expert on minority representation and democratic participation in the Philippines, her home country. And Dr. Michael Wesley, executive director of the Lowy Institute for International Policy. Their opponents on the affirmative were Carmen Lawrence, who you heard from earlier, who was followed by Ambassador M.K. Bhadrakumar, the former Indian ambassador to Pakistan, Iran, Turkey and Russia, amongst other countries, and Professor Greg Craven, Vice-Chancellor of the Australian Catholic University. To see the debate that democracy is not for everyone in full, either tune to ABC2 this Thursday at 5:35pm or go online anytime and watch, listen or download the debate in its entirety. The debate was part of the recent Festival of Dangerous Ideas presented by the Sydney Opera House and the St James Ethics Centre. This is 4A Radio on ABC Radio National and Radio Australia and online. I'm Paul Barclay. Let's take you now to Melbourne and highlights of the recent Alfred Deakin Eco-Innovation Lecture Series. Your speaker is Dr. David Mills, academic, researcher, entrepreneur and tireless promoter of solar energy. David Mills is the founder and chief scientific officer of OSRA Inc., a Californian-Australian company that builds solar steam technology. He spent 33 years developing solar energy technologies at the Universities of New South Wales and Sydney and managed the research program that developed absorber coatings now used in vacuum tube solar water heaters throughout China. In this lecture, David Mills outlines why the photon economy should be the inspiration for our energy needs. Here now is David Mills.
Photons are unimaginably small entities which we cannot visualize, both because they're incredibly small and because they have aspects of both solid matter and waves that our senses are not equipped to process. But we can and do sense large numbers of them as light and radiant heat. Indeed, without the myriads we experience every day reflected from our surroundings, we couldn't see anything at all. Most of the photons we interact with are produced by nuclear fusion reactions inside our favorite star, the Sun, and they stream down on our planet as solar energy. These photons are the source of all the energy used by living beings in the Earth's biosphere. Photons provide energy to drive the wind and waves in our climate system. This combined energy and climate system is billions of years old and thousands of times larger than our fossil-fueled commercial energy economy. Although volcanoes and earthquakes result from heating by radioactive decay in the depths of the Earth, that source of heat is very small by comparison. Practically all of the energy that warms the surface of the Earth comes from solar photons. Solar energy is not a resource for just a few lucky nations. It's everywhere. Our beautiful blue planet is a very special one. Accepting photons from its star and radiating them away at just the right rate to maintain a surface temperature on the Earth such that water is mostly kept in the liquid state, which we need to survive. Therefore, it's excellent real estate for us, and then it's in the best part of town if you look at where it's placed in the galaxy. Everyone knows that trees and plants provide the oxygen that we breathe and decrease carbon dioxide, but green plants also darken the Earth's surface and affect the Earth's reflectivity, sometimes called the albedo. That regulates our temperature helps regulate our temperature to comfortable levels. Trees in the high latitudes grow slowly and absorb more sunlight than the snow underneath would have, and therefore, by virtue of being there, they warm the Earth. Trees near the equator grow vigorously and pull carbon out of the atmosphere, and they cool the Earth. Trees planted in temperate climates are these days thought to have little effect on the climate, so remember that when you do your next carbon offset. The best scheme that we would have is to stop cutting trees down in Sumatra, Brazil, and the Congo. Plants and algae are ancient life forms that have had more time to become energetically sophisticated than we are. Instead of having to burn pieces of wood or lumps of coal or hydrocarbons to keep warm, or instead of having to eat other species, they're able to borrow photons directly from the photon river incident on the Earth using the process of photosynthesis. After the energy absorbed has been used to build tissues or create growth, the leftover heat from the process joins the outbound river of infrared photons that travel back into space, cooling the Earth. Plants have shown that tapping temporarily into our huge river of photons is truly sustainable. They've been doing it for billions of years. So the natural photon-based ecology is safe and it's resilient and should be the inspiration for our commercial energy economy. Currently, it is not. Our prehistoric human economy was originally built largely around hunting and gathering food generated by solar photons. It was a photon-based economy. The main reasons for the recent focus on coal and oil are the exceptional energy density of fossil fuels and the fact that they can be easily transported and sold. In the early 20th century, you couldn't transport sunlight or wind, but you could make a global business out of extracting and transporting fossil fuel. So fossil fuel is solar energy, which has been stored by nature in chemical form in the Earth over millions of years. It arrives slowly, but can be liberated quickly. Now, that would not be such a problem if the reaction products from combustion were harmless. But combustion of fuel damages the thermal regulation of the atmosphere through carbon-based pollutants such as carbon dioxide, black soot, and leakages of methane. That increases the net number of photons absorbed and causes global warming. The move away from photons to fossil fuel was a factor in the rapid economic development of Western society in the 19th and 20th centuries, but you may be surprised to learn that fossil fuel was never a necessity for modern civilization to happen. Welding of metals was practiced by Europeans in Leonardo's time using focused solar beams. Water mills provided hydraulic power in 1759. Between 1832 and 1839, Robert Anderson of Scotland invented the first crude electric carriage. A small-scale electric car was designed by a professor in Groningen, Holland, and built by his assistant in 1835. Practical and more successful electric vote vehicles were invented by both American Thomas Davenport and Scotsman Robert Davidson around 1842. An early solar plant around 1890 in Needles, California, had thermal storage. In 1885, alternating current hydroelectricity was developed by Nikola Tesla and George Westinghouse. Frank Schumann built a solar plant in Egypt in 1912, which pumped water but could easily have driven an electric generator. And in fact, there were magazines of the time which sketched such a system exactly. An iron-based battery car devised by a partnership between Thomas Edison and Henry Ford lost a market battle with petrol car companies, even though the early battery problems had been solved by that time. Solar water heaters on homes were widespread in 1920. Some of you will see the heater in that photograph on the top right. It looks just like today. One could go on and on. A non-carbon economy was about to happen a century ago, but we took a wrong turn. Why did we do that? Well, one thing that held back the photon economy was the lack of a large electricity distribution grid. This allows the transport and sale of renewable energy in electrical form. Otherwise, it's a bit hard to transfer for sunlight in a bottle. But although invented by Edison in the 1880s, the electric grid has taken many, many years to establish. It was not by any means complete, and so most people had to do something else. More money could be made in 1920 by mining and transporting the fossilized concentrated solar energy called coal and oil than by surfing the photon river. And of course, nobody had yet heard of global warming. Had we not discovered oil and large coal reserves and the means to extract them quickly, where would we be now? Well, we might be healthier because we would have a clean atmosphere. We would not fear global warming. We probably wouldn't even know about it at this stage. The streets would be quiet because we'd be running electric vehicles. Perhaps we would be wealthier as well because we could have powered our economy without the import of oil from other countries, and we would not have faced expensive energy war politics and the health costs of pollution that we now bear. Okay, so I always get the question, why not use nuclear power? Well, we already have a really large, free fusion reactor of an advanced type available to anyone at a safe distance of 140 million kilometers, and we do not have to worry about radioactive waste from that particular one. Even if one used up all of the warheads, there isn't enough fuel to last beyond mid-century at current reactor numbers, unless when one invokes the fast breeder plutonium economy. And about the plutonium economy, in 2003, an MIT report was written about that and deemed it unacceptably dangerous. This was written by nuclear people. This is mainly a terrorism issue because it involves transport of plutonium around the country. With or without the fast breeder, harvesting neutrons on the Earth involves technology that can be used to make bombs and terrorist devices. India and Pakistan are perfect examples of how weapons can proliferate from a supposedly peaceful program. And the current debate about Iran is just a taste of the chaos we can expect with widespread nuclear power. In the end, the solution for global warming is not nuclear winter. In fact, the neutron economy is not the path proven by nature at all. It is the photon path. In the new photon economy, things that burn fossil fuel are replaced by photon trapping devices we can make and sell. These are called solar collectors or direct solar energy converters, and that's what we do in our company. But solar photons also stir up the atmosphere to produce winds and waves and ocean currents, and these are also ways to tap into the photon river or the energy from it. These are called indirect solar energy, and the products are called wind turbines, water turbines, and wave generators. As part of the photon economy, there might be other actions. It might be cheaper to sell more efficient products of all types that simply use less energy. But we need a system that rewards such energy saving appropriately. And California, as in one of many innovative programs, introduced such a system in the 80s, in which electric and gas utilities were paid the same whether or not they saved energy or generated more. Californian energy usage has been held constant now for 2 decades under that system, and it is now much lower per capita than the other U.S. states. The Earth cares little about whether we increase efficiency or use more zero-emissions energy, so whatever's the cheapest is best. I believe that the cheapest renewable energy will come from large distance sources, like solar power plants and wind turbines, in dedicated parks away from the home. Connecting the home, the factory, the office, and the car to distant clean electricity generation infrastructure is essential to attacking global warming quickly because it uses the infrastructure we already have. It minimizes changes to buildings, it leaves most of the maintenance with the utility. A U.S. study has shown that an electrified vehicle sector would actually improve grid economics because the underutilized grid at night would be used for vehicle charging. And in fact, I have a plug-in hybrid vehicle in California, of course, being a bit of a tech head, and I do plug it in at night and try to help the grid that way. And I can drive 2 days back and forth and commuting without any use of fossil fuel whatsoever. So when I'm not using my bike, that's my method of choice. How do we get the electricity in the first place? Well, I think there'll be four main, this is my opinion only, mind you, and others will differ, there'll be four main types of photon-powered technology for that. There are many more possibilities, but these seem to be big ones and almost ready ones, or ready ones. They all exist already, but some are young and evolving rapidly. The first to arrive commercially was hydroelectricity in 1882. Hydroelectricity was the largest generator in the USA and Australia from the 30s to the 50s. After 130 years, its potential is already used up in much of the developed world, where it's beginning to decrease because of declining snowmelt. Run-of-river hydro is a different way of doing it. You basically put a turbine in the river and just let it twirl around. And that's beginning to be popular for small installations because it doesn't affect the river flow or fish. But it's not so predictable and large scale as a dam. There's been recent criticism of dams in the tropics because flooded vegetation can give off methane in warm climates, which in the worst cases can cause as much global warming as a coal-fired plant. So you have to be a bit careful. However, dams in colder climates seem to be okay, and they can provide valuable, dependable power and control of water for agriculture. The next to develop commercially was wind. The first known electricity-generating windmill operated was a battery charging machine installed in 1887 by a Scotsman, James Blythe. The first windmill as an electricity producer in the United States was a 12-kilowatt machine, which some of you can see in the photo here, used by Charles Brush in 1888, not much later. The 1880s were obviously a fervent time for technology. By the 1930s, hundreds of thousands of small wind generators were being used in the farms in the United States that were off-grid. Much larger machines were subsequently developed to a higher level by the Danes in the 1960s and 1980s, resulting in the three-bladed design common today, which you see in the picture. California incentives of the 80s and 90s established the commercial wind industry, but it finally achieved hive growth in the mid-1990s and really took off. This high rate of manufacture has gone on for quite some time, increasing for most of the decade at about 28% per year, which is a phenomenal increased rate. But it also dropped the price of wind generation, so that in many places wind is as cheap as fossil fuel per kilowatt hour. Generators are now everywhere in Europe and are spreading rapidly in China. Spain established its wind incentive program around the turn of the century, and wind capacity grew 8 times in 8 years. Spain receives 11% of its annual electricity from wind. On one day in last year, 43% of the electricity in the whole country was supplied by wind. The downside of wind is its unpredictability. Wind is usually limited to about 20% of annual generation because of concerns about grid stability. However, recent analysis has shown that if you have a very large group of wind generators over on a continental scale, or hundreds of thousands of generators, some of them will be going at any one time. They'll never all be shut down. That has been looked at statistically, and it comes to around a minimum of 33%. A third of the generators are going to be going in a large system. And if there is an effective interconnect over the continent, these are available as baseload power for the grid. Wind started its big push in the global market around 1995 and grew very quickly, but it's starting to slow down and is operating at about 23% per year. But we're going to have to use wind to succeed in near-term environmental measures because it's low cost and it's ready to go. And I think it will be a great success, but it will need partner technologies and system to provide a dependable service. Now, there's no shortage of wind, I should say. The economically viable wind resources that exist on land alone, this is not including the resources offshore, are more than 4 times projected total world energy demand in 2010. The third technology to become commercial was solar power, photovoltaic power, or PV. PV converts sunlight directly into DC electricity using semiconductor material. In 1839, Alexander von Becquerel discovered the photoelectric effect, where the conductance of metal through an electrolyte increases with illumination. The photoelectric effect was explained by Albert Einstein in 1904, but well before that, in 1877, Charles Fritz in the United States had patented the first selenium solar cell, and it had 1% efficiency. And that may seem kind of useless, but in fact, that became the, if some of you remember the old cameras that we used to have before the digital age and the little meter that went back and forth in your Spotmatic or whatever, that was a selenium solar cell, in fact. And so they were used for over 100 years. Bell Labs, in 1952, and that's the picture that we just went through, demonstrated a solar cell which became a prototype for those used in space, and then we see here one being installed on a satellite prior to launch. By 1983, the sales were $250 million a year, and PV started to get large-scale market traction about 2005, about 10 years after wind. And now it's going up pretty much like a rocket. Between 2006 and 2008, the industry was growing at the rate of 50% per year. So very staggering. And this year, a single project of 2,000 megawatts, has been announced in China, using American technology, low-cost for solar technology based on cadmium telluride. The size of that array is bigger than Manhattan. So solar is actually transitioning, and this is the biggest solar plant in the world. The next major technology is concentrating solar thermal, and it has various names, solar thermal electricity, concentrated solar power, but I'll follow the current Australian nomenclature in calling it concentrating solar thermal, or CST. We'll just call it that for this meeting and hope nobody's confused. In short, CST involves using reflectors to produce temperatures high enough to raise steam for a conventional steam turbine, and then from that point on, it's just a conventional system. Also, it can provide temperatures high enough for high-temperature thermodynamic cycles, such as the Brayton cycle used in jet engines. But basically, it uses mirrors without the smoke, if you can think of it that way. Many environmentalists like or express a dislike of large systems and see the push for sustainability as an opportunity to advocate self-sufficiency. They'd like to have their home on their own or be autonomous. That's been a wish for a long time. Go back to Thoreau and probably a lot earlier than that. But Humanity has come this far precisely because we are good at cooperation, and an integrated system is cheaper to construct and much easier to maintain than many, many small systems. So we think that connectivity is the key, and people should live in cities more, not so much in the country, so that the nature can recover. But they should be connected. There's a strength in connection, there's a redundancy in connection. Many business people are unhappy about having to make changes away from the fossil fuel economy. Well, they have to change too. It's not just the environmental stuff to change, the business people have to change. And the most innovative of these will flourish, and the ones that can't adapt will fail. That's the hard world that we're told we live in. I think this is as it should be in that kind of environment. So we are all embedded in both the economy and the environment, and we need to quickly evolve systems that work in both realms. So much has happened in the last few years. There's been a huge change in how governments in the world talk about climate change and renewable energy. Now instead of something in the corner, solar energy is the thing that's going to save the economy. I don't know if you've noticed that, but Obama talks that way. Most of the European leaders talk that way. When I lived in Australia in 2007, John Howard was saying that solar energy could not run a modern economy. Conventional industry lobbying was hampering new development, and industry didn't have confidence if the government wasn't going to support it. Now solar is business gold. The U.S. is giving much more assistance to renewables than to coal and nuclear, which is interesting, and that's the first time that's happened. Always nuclear got the most in the United States, and coal got the most here. Why is that? Because wind, PV, and CST have all been shown to work. That's a very important thing. They all can be installed quickly, and actually they rocket up because they're manufactured energy, if you think about it. It's not handmade plants anymore. It's manufactured and factory-made items and automated. And they protect the climate on a long-term basis. They are truly sustainable. Germany has 30,000 people working in the solar industry, and that's equal to the entire workforce presently engaged in mining and distributing Australian black coal. So a few years ago, it was over 10 years ago, I think, New South Wales did a study and found the number of people working in renewable energy exceeded that in conventional energy. But they tend not to be very politically powerful because they're all driving a truck, putting up a solar collector or something. They're all small business people, always in a hurry and not very organized. But these industries are actually getting large already. Wind is growing at 30 gigawatts per year, 30,000 megawatts per year. PV at 7, and I think CST is perhaps half that, but it's coming up extremely rapidly. Each gigawatt is worth about between $1.5 and $5 billion. So that gives you some scope of the business. The business is well into the big numbers. The government started off well and last year committed $435 million to the Renewable Energy Demonstration Program for the demonstration of large-scale renewable energy projects and also announced a fast-tracking of that at the end of the year with funding to be allocated over 18 months. That seemed wonderful. In April, everybody submitted their REDP applications. We submitted four in the company. In May, that was all changed. We adopted the Solar Flagships Program, and the government announced that $300 million of the REDP funds would be reallocated to non-solar projects. So we lost $300 million in the short term. But we thought that meant at least there's $135 million still in there. So we'll go for that. But that was not true. Sorry. The sum was reduced then to $100 million. $35 million just evaporated. We're not sure where that went. And that $100 million is now being allocated across all renewable technologies and not specifically for solar. So actually all the solars have been left out. So it's not really a fast track. It's a kind of a shell game from where we see it. And now you see it, now you don't. We think that can be improved, that performance, and we think it's necessary. It's the Prime Minister himself who has said that business demands clarity. And the renewable energy industry is not getting clarity right now. So the government should, for one thing, stop the practice of announcing new programs which delay the implementation of the old program. It used to be the new government that did that, but it's quite a new thing for the same government to deactivate its own programs. It should expedite those programs as originally promised. Now, the flagships are a great step forward, and the industry needs that, but it also needs a transition. You know, a flagship program is 100 times bigger than the thing we installed at Liddell. To think that we can go from something fairly small to something huge like this without an intermediate step is a bit strange. And yet, with new technologies, you have to learn on the way. And so the R&D program was the right size, in fact, to make intermediate projects. And to withdraw it, I can't see why you would do that. I think a vibrant solar industry could be the salvation of the Australian economy, just as China thinks that's true of their economy and just as the United States thinks that's true of their economy. There's an enormous solar potential in northwest Australia, close to Asian markets. We have the largest desert in the hemisphere in the northwest. Imagine a huge high-voltage DC line going up through Indonesia to help power Southeast Asia, the largest solar line in the world. Got to think big. And this would be the world's largest clean energy superhighway. Imagine clean solar fuels being produced in the northwest or the east coast and exported from the terminals that now handle liquid natural gas. Imagine low-cost, pollution-free solar powering of minerals processing. Instead of just shipping out the iron ore, you have the energy there already. You have the sun there already. You can actually produce electricity. You can produce heat. You can do all of these things, process the ore there, and ship out the secondary processing or the pellets or whatever goes on. Get a higher value added that way. Imagine reducing petrol imports to zero using a total electrified vehicle system and actually generating a lot of the new technology required to do that. You have to grasp the future. You really do. I mean, this is the future that Australia could have, but governments have to embrace it, and they have to stop clinging to the past. Whatever happens in the coal industry happens because other people somewhere else have decided that they don't want to use coal anymore or do want to use coal anymore in the future. So we have no control over that, but if they decide not to use coal, what is Plan B? We need Plan B, and it's time to really consider that. At the heart of our old-fashioned thinking is the arrogance of outdated economic and religious dogmas, which teach the dominance of mankind over nature. It doesn't look like we're very dominant when something like that happens. This leads naturally to the notion of dominance of large corporations over the lives and futures of ordinary Australians. Instead, we need to focus not on dominion over nature, but on human survival and integration with nature. We have to decide whether we want to be the caretaker or the corpse. Ultimately, it's an ethical question, not an economic one. Do we care about our children? Do we care about other species? We disparage Wall Street greed, but are we better than Gordon Gekko's children if we sell out Australia's future in the mistaken belief that this can protect a few dying companies? What is right, it should be what advances and protects lives of those children and their descendants and other species and the planetary environment. What's wrong leads to the destruction of those things. Now, our task is not simply a technical challenge like solar power. That part I enjoy and I'm excited about. It's kind of fun, it's fulfilling, but it's the easy part. Now, the hard part is that we have to actively understand and respect the complicated and beautiful systems and species that inhabit our world. That is the discipline that the photon economy demands. Otherwise, we'll eventually make the wrong turn that proves to be fatal. Alan Kay, a computer scientist in California, says, "The best way to predict the future isn't to invent it." I like that positive note. If so, then this is perhaps our biggest challenge, because having a future at all seems to demand that we reinvent ourselves. Thanks very much.
David Mills, delivering the recent Alfred Deakin Eco-Innovation Lecture. To hear his address in full on the photon economy, you can go online and visit ABC Fora. When it becomes available, a link to the talk will be posted here on the Fora Radio website, abc.net.au/rn/Fora Radio. And that's it for Fora Radio today. Hope you can join me again tomorrow for Australia Talks, especially if you're the musical type. 4 million Australians play an instrument or sing. Are you in a garage band, a choir? Do you dabble in jazz or sing at your church? That's tomorrow on Australia Talks. Call in or listen in when we beat the drum for community music. I'll speak to you then. Paul Barclay here from Australia Talks. The Rugby League State of Origin, Wimbledon, the AFL Grand Final. We're a nation of armchair sportsmen and women, But would you be prepared to pay to watch sport on TV? The rules guaranteeing sporting events being shown on free-to-air are under review. Listen now or download as an MP3 podcast from the Radio National website at abc.net.au/rn and follow the prompts to Australia Talks.